This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 6th of December, 1952. The title of this lecture is Axioms and Logics, Further Data. This lecture is 60 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Arrow Productions.
And this is the Saturday night lecture. December the 6th, take up here in the first hour a few more of these axioms and logics. See what we can get out of these things. We've already covered gradient scales. We found out that gradient scales had a considerable importance in auditing. The whole background of creative processing could be said to be the proper understanding and handling of gradient scales. And really, a gradient scale would be a little more of what was, and then a little more of what was a little more of, and then a little more of what was a little more of, a little more of. And so we could reach out then from the tiniest point into the widest possible sphere. Now, talking here in these logics about very shifty words, things like truth. You start talking about truth, you start talking about truth. And you start talking about anything in this stratosphere of knowledge, and it's susceptible to many opinions and so on. A lot of people have been going around saying this was truth and that was truth and so forth. We have two truths that we're working with. The possibility of there being an infinite truth, but which to us at this time is not definable, and so is itself a possibility. And the other is a workable truth. Another kind of truth, just a workable truth. Therefore, anything is true which is workable. And what is workable? Workability is the capability of starting, changing, and stopping. And the degree of capability of starting, changing, and stopping would demonstrate for this universe workability. And when you say starting, changing, and stopping what, you have immediately gone too far, and you should just drop that and sort of back off rather abashed, because it really applies to anything in this universe. This universe is built almost wholly upon the principle of start, change, and stop. Now, I don't know what the workability of a truth would be outside of a cycle of action, unless it would be the workability of a postulate. So you say, let there be light, and there's light. Well, that was a workable postulate, wasn't it? And you say, let there be camels with spin-armed hecticles on them. And there are camels with horn-spinned recticles on them. And you say, that was a workable truth then, wasn't it? We're moving into some other little sphere here, aren't we? And so you say, let there be darkness. Let there be a God. Let there be a devil. Let there be General Motors and Westinghouse. Anything you care to say. And if that is immediately demonstrable as a workability, then by our definition, it is a truth. That's quite simple, isn't it? If you were operating then in a vacuum of no space, that's a pretty trick thing, a no-space vacuum operating in a no-space area where there is no space, but only the capability and potentiality of space. If you had all these things then, and you didn't have anything there, I mean, you had true static, no motion, no wavelength, nothing, why, one could theoretically postulate anything and have it become a truth. Well, now it gets out a little bit further. And it says, a truth for whom? Well, for him. He's operating from a no space, no wavelength, no mass, no velocity, no geographical location, and he makes a postulate and it comes true. And who is it true for? It's true for the individual who makes the postulate. Well, oddly enough, a fellow has to be in pretty good condition in order to make a postulate and have it be true for him. In creative processing, you found that little difficulty there. You make this postulate, or you made this postulate, and it is either too true, or you can't make it come true. There are several squirrels. Squirrel is a technical term. A squirrel is somebody who invents something that he knows won't work in order to get some nut to audit. That's a squirrel. There are some squirrels who go around and they pick up a fragment of the subject and they go around and they sell this thing like mad. They just overplay it. Well, one of these squirrels, not too long ago, listened to the first half of a lecture tape. And this lecture was concerned with self-determinism. And it tried to treat this whole subject of postulates and said there is really no reason why a person couldn't simply say, I am now a self-determined individual, and it had come true, because that's a postulate. There isn't any reason why he couldn't do that. The first hour of this two-hour lecture was devoted to why you couldn't simply say you were self-determined, be self-determined, speed up your governor, knock everything together the way you wanted to, and have tremendous effectiveness thereafter. And the second hour is devoted to why that can't happen. Well, they threw away the second hour, and Machiavelli wrote a book once called The Prince, and The Prince has its first part, How to Become a Great Ruler. And the second part, it says how to stay there. And Napoleon and Hitler and all sorts of people down through the lines have been saying, they've been reading Machiavelli's Prince, and they've been putting it into action like mad, and they take the first half, and then they never read the second half. They never have, and they don't stay there. Well, the second half of this lecture was devoted to and contained some of this data, devoted to why that postulate couldn't suddenly stick. Ever since that time, we've been having people spin like mad around in various locales. They say, I'm a self-determined individual. You say I'm not? That's what's known as circuit determinism, a little bit different than self-determinism. What they do is set themselves up. You get this fellow and he drags himself out of this river and he's just got through swimming for steadily and solidly for 18 hours and he's all worn out and he's just about to hand in his chips and so forth. And then just as he comes out of the river, you get a hold of him, you take him to the scruff of the neck, and you say, all right, now tell yourself that you're well, that you feel good, that you're not cold, that you're perfectly rested, and come on out here. We've got a quarter horse for you to race. He'll say, all right, I'm all rested. He's liable to agree with you, and he's even liable to do it out of agreement, but there isn't very much going to happen. And that's because he's making a postulate while still holding on to the composite of postulates which bring him into the reality in which he insists on existing. Now, if you make a postulate out of no motion, no space, no geographical location, or any other influence, why, sure, you can make any postulate you please. But after you've made 100,000 million postulates, and you've got yourself nicely stacked around with cycles of action and messed and agreements and responsibilities and subject to forces, and you own this and something else has you, why, then you suddenly say when you're in that state, now I change my mind about this whole thing, and while still sitting right here and being very insistent on holding on to all that I have, which I acquired solely by the process of making postulates, I'm now going to hold on to all that. And I'm just going to sort of sneak over here covertly, and I'm going to say, well, I'm holding on to that, but I'm going to say, I am now self-determined as an individual. And then I'm going to make that stick. As long as the fellow held on to his havingness and the substance of the messed universe, the identity which has been assigned to him, and all these other things, He, of course, is holding on to a large mass of postulates. He's holding on to an enormous number of them, and insisting then, by holding on to them, that these other postulates have complete validity. And while he insists on this complete validity, he goes out and says sincerely, I am now a self-determined individual, and just by making a postulate, I can make it come true. And he's saying, you better not invalidate me. Well, he's invalidating himself. He's insisting on going along and remaining in the unchanged status quo of being where he is, what he is, owning what he does own, and responsible for what he has. Well, these boys found that out immediately, really, only they didn't observe what they found out. They found out immediately that all you had to do was postulate you were self-determined, and in the process of trying to make it stick, you had to kick all your friends in their teeth, you had to leave the family, you had to change over any possible method of life in which you were operating. They did the same trick, however, in spite of all of these changes that would take place. They took place chaotically, catastrophically. These changes occurred because they couldn't regulate the thing. They didn't know what was occurring to them. And here, suddenly, they wind up in terrible condition. Well, this is the magician. He goes out and he says, well, let's throw a little bit of spider's brains in here and a few threads of dawn, and let's mix them up with a frog's cough and expose them out very nicely to the Stygian core of blackness, say three chants over them, and now, let's see, what was I doing here? Oh, yeah, well, let's pour some of this on the ground. Well, look at that. Imagine that. A tree starts growing, and it just keeps eating everything up and so forth. Well, isn't that interesting? And all of a sudden he says, gee, it's getting dark around here. Wonder what's taking place. And he looks up and he says, well, this tree is sort of swamping everything. It's cutting out the sunlight in all directions, and I better find my cave if I can find my cave. But no, it's now too dark and there is no cave. And gee whiz, that tree, so-and-so, and he goes on, and then he starts cursing the tree. And he says, look what that tree did to me. Look how mean and ornery that tree was. Look at all these horrible things this tree is doing. And another magician sees him one day as he's ruined, hobbling down along the road, and this fellow complains to him bitterly about what the tree did to him. He did several things wrong. The first thing he did wrong was to mix up a lot of things without postulating why he was doing it. He didn't say what the end product would be. The second, he failed to say what the end product, what his goal was, and why he was trying to achieve that goal. He immediately abandoned the plateau of cause and stepped down to the valley of effect. The moment that he was there in effect, then what he had already caused grew up, shut out the light, and he said, well, I have no responsibility for it. I'm being affected by it badly. He goes downhill further. Now, if something else happens to him, he complains about that, and he complains about something else. He never makes a statement to himself what goal he's trying to achieve, what he's trying to do. He just goes on. One day, he suddenly mixes up a Las Vegas and a little bit of Faro with a blonde in New York, and takes a train and says, well, we'll leave it all to chance, and I guess I've got this job. I don't know what I'm doing, but I can hope. And he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because they tell him he can live for the minute. Or I don't know, maybe they give them more than a minute in Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe they give them 5 minutes or 24 hours or something at a crack. They ration their time. Gosh, this guy's in terrible shape. He's become Homo sapiens. Now, all this fella has to do, he hears one day, he says, now all I've got to do is just postulate that I'm self-determined. Of course, he doesn't know what self-determinism is. He has no definition of that or anything of the sort. He merely says, he postulates, it is a state in which I can do what I please without incurring any penalty. Therefore, if I say I'm self-determined, then I don't have to take any responsibility whatsoever for anything bad that I do, because it's on my self-determinism, and that well worked out. That equates perfectly. He said that's a wonderful state of affairs. And, of course, people keep hitting him with axes and throwing him into gutters and throwing him this way and that way, and it's all backwards. You get the difference, then. You get the difference, then, between a clear-cut series of postulates, which could become truths, and a clear-cut chunk of chaos, which most men consider their lives should be. Not could be, it should be. There's a big difference there. So when we're talking about truth, we're talking about another level of truth. When we say postulates, all right, let's take another level of truth now. Let's take the truth called meshed universe. This truth is composite out of a series of agreements. After this fellow's made a few postulates, he get a hold of a few friends, and for the sake of randomity, they all agree that such and such is going to take place, and that when so-and-so makes a postulate, when they all agree upon this postulate, then this postulate is there and then going to become common to all of them. And they think that's grand, and that's a good game, and we can play this game with impunity. Well, they can play it just so long, and then the randomity starts to set up. The postulate, then, is losing its value as single truth and becomes relative to those agreements which have been made amongst them. Now, this fellow one day says, I'm now going to postulate that I'm going to have a new palace. And the others say, that's out of agreement. You know very well that we invented a labor union, and the labor union gets just so much money an hour, and all that sort of thing, and they have to go over, and we've got to have a quarry, and you'll have to own the land of the quarry, and you'll have to get a permit in order to quarry stone, and you'll have to get an interstate trucking license in order to haul that stone over here, and we'll have to hire masons, and there's unemployment tax and there's Social Security, and everybody knows that you can't pay anything like that for anything of the sort, and you don't have any chips. And the fellow said, well, not too long ago, I used to say, well, I make a stack of money, so forth. I can pay all those things. And no, they say that on this agreement, why we've agreed that the only currency is that currency on which we've agreed. And you say, well, I didn't agree to that currency. I wasn't there. And he said, you agreed to an army to protect our property, didn't you? And the fellow says, well, yes, I did. And they say, well, they protect the currency now. Let's have no more of that. And so you've got a cycle going in which the postulate is actually as valid as it is related to the agreed subject. And after a while, his postulate gets very weak indeed. He says, I think I will have a glass of water, providing nobody objects. And to have a glass of water, the best thing to do, you walk over to a tap and you turn the tap on. You have a glass there, imagine it. You have a glass there to catch the water in, and you have to have a stomach and a mouth to drink it with, and so forth, and you're all set then. And this big agreement becomes what? Natural law or truth. That's truth. What is truth for this land? They have a standing army and trade unions and all the rest of this. That's truth. Now an engineer comes along and he decides in this land to build a bridge. And there's a darn many agreements that he's lost all track of, that the first time he puts up this flimsy structure and so on, why the first passenger, as he starts to go across, the thing goes boom. So the engineer said, there are other natural laws which I now have to follow. And these laws must be this way and this way. And so he's doing a blind job of tracking agreements about gravity, about wavelength, about strength of structure, about the growth of trees, all of these things. He's tracking back agreements. He's working it out to find out what agrees with this chunk of whatever it is, alabaster, mud, whatever he's trying to build the bridge across or out of. He's got to find out what this score is straight through, in order to build something which sufficiently agrees with the environment to permit its continuance in the environment. And his study becomes a study of then what has been agreed, although most of that has been lost. And so he does it by test. He puts the bridge there, and if it stands, it doesn't stand. He's investigating the environment continually. He'll make little mock-up bridges. And he'll hit little mock-up bridges, as nice as you please, to find out if they break. And then he does a calculation to find out how much stronger he's got to build the main bridge that goes across this stream. And he finally works it out. And how strong are the girders? What's the uniformity of construction? What are the metals? What are the refining processes? How skilled do the workmen have to be? And what are all these things? And finally, there he is. Then he falls into a delusion. He starts thinking, well, now, look, I was agreeing with reality. This was really real, because working out that bridge was a real tough job. And the funny darn part of it is every time I build a bridge, it doesn't build according to different laws. It builds according to these same laws. There's the coefficient of expansion, there's friction, there's all these weights and stress analysis of structure, and there's torsion and tension and all these things, and there's the vibration of foot traffic and the vibration of vehicles, and these things don't vary. And I build this bridge and that bridge and another bridge, and gee, he says, you know, we're right here in the midst of a method of building bridges, and we have agreed with natural law thoroughly and completely, and we can keep on building beautiful bridges as long as we keep on agreeing. It's a funny thing about his bridges. The only thing that happens, that's a wonderful thing that he can do that. He then has a hatful of the most beautiful worked out technology. And he has in his possession the only thoroughly tested technology which agrees with natural law. Because he's working with the most basic natural law there is, and that is structure, gravity, materiel. And that's as close as he can get to natural law. And that's about as close as you can get to the natural law of any universe, is with the very woof and warp of that universe itself. He should never, however, make the mistake of thinking that that is reality. That is agreement with the agreement which is the reality of that universe. It would be with a horrible shock that he would suddenly find himself in another universe starting to build a bridge which used the coefficient of expansion, which used this, and find out that that bridge went down. Vroom. And somebody'd come along, some old man be coming along there, and he'd say, what you trying to do, bud? And the engineer'd say, I'm trying to build a bridge. He's trying to build a what? I'm trying to build a bridge. Well, what for? And to get across this chasm. And the old man'd say, well, what do you need a bridge to get across the chasm for? And the engineer'd say, well, obviously it's empty space. And the old man would suddenly say, it is? For heaven's sakes, I'll have to go tell my father about that, and would walk across the empty space very neatly and very nicely. And the engineer would be very puzzled until he found out that in that area, the shoes of everybody concerned with everything was adjusted to core gravity distance. That is to say, the distance to the core of any planet on which they were operating had an adjustment in their shoes. And the way this was put in was by baking up something that looked like a mass of taffy. And he says, oh, no. But that's actually about the way it would be. Now, it's an incomprehensible thing, perhaps, to look at these things. And if you've ever run a car into a brick wall, or seen a train go off girders into a river, or seen any of these horrendous things happen, it's sort of difficult to say it happened because of an agreement. It makes a flimsy look. But the very funny thing about the whole deal is that the engineer cannot obtain an absolute anywhere. And the harder he works, he just can't obtain an absolute. He's almost there on any one of his natural laws, but not quite. Fortunately, there is never 100% agreement. There's always a hole in the natural law. There's always a hole in the atom, always a hole in the structure. He starts into the actual complexity of this matter, and does he become complex? He is complicated beyond measure because its consistency and so forth keeps shifting under his hands as he examines it. He becomes very puzzled after a while. You know, it's a strange thing that the search after truth, then, could lead some men to disaster and some to glory. It could lead Newton into great renown. It could lead Hegel into disrepute. It could lead Lenin into an early tomb. They're all going after what? Different kinds of a datum. A truth is something which would exist without much contest, something which is triumphant, a champion who stands up after a battle with bloodied shield and sword and yet has won, is himself truth in the force universe. A datum which itself sweeps all data before it in another universe is truth. It is that which works, and that which works most broadly to that which it is applied. Have pity upon some of your preclears who are still scrambling in some direction and haven't ever classified the field of truth in which they're searching for the truth. Some are searching for it in the messed universe, and some are searching for it out in the stars, and some are searching for it in their own hearts, and others are searching for it in the lives of great men. And sure enough, they will, every one of them, find a truth. And all they need to do is to find the ultimate truth, is simply find the winning truth by which all other truths proceed in that field. And if you ever build yourself a universe, go park the truth on which it is built on the first piece of structure that you may build, and engrave it well, and don't make it mysterious. Because the only way to make your universe survive forever and last forever and be there and be at last in command of you is to invent the truth that started it and then hide that truth. And if you were to do that, then neither you nor any inhabitant in the universe would be able to undo the universe or alter it in any way, but it would simply go out on an inevitable average proceeding from that truth. And that first truth would simply be a postulate made out of the zero of no motion, no space, no geographical location, and without time. And it's made there. It is not associated to any other times, places, or agreements. Now, it's the first agreement on that sequence on which you then compound all other logic. And oddly enough, it can be any first statement. You can go out here and construct a whole mathematics, a beautiful mathematics, but a gorgeous mathematics, on the whole system that any time X and Y appear, they are pluses and minuses. And that any time they are used or equated in equations, they will always be pluses and minuses. And that the action of pluses and minuses is that they come together but repel them from themselves, each one of themselves. Interesting mathematics. Another one, that every 10, when divided by 2, equals 15. Anything. Anything idiotic. It doesn't matter what it is. Suddenly carved out of the nowhere of a beginning, you'd see there is no beginning before a beginning. Because any one of you can assume in any field of ideas, instantly assume that without recourse to any prior idea, we are now going to postulate that so and so is going to regulate and regiment a core of proceeding fact. And unless you forced it into agreement with some other body of information, you could have a tremendous body of data. You say it'd be idle. Oh, no, it wouldn't be idle. It could keep on going to a point where it became relative to itself. And becoming relative to itself could itself be a universe. It is symbolical, that line in the Bible that says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The day when you state a postulate to begin a universe, you are creating a God as well, and it is the God of that universe. Now, relative truths would have then to do with their relative workability, and what could be true in any field could be true for that field, but is not necessarily true for another field. What's true for one universe is not true for another universe. What we have scouted in Scientology, what we've looked over, is the messed universe parade of agreement stemming from the first capability, the first cue that we can discover, which describes the capabilities of theta as we can view them from this point. We see that from that, all other capabilities could have proceeded which brought about the messed universe, and we understand by that immediately that the capability of theta at the level of Q1 could consist of the ability to create space and energy and time, or to locate energy and matter in time and space. We could take this level of workability, then we can cite that here, and we find out it applies through all of these various mechanisms in which anyone is engaged in this universe, and so we have a senior truth. That truth is probably a little bit senior to any necessary for this universe. It's probably just a little bit, because this universe has immediately omitted creation of space as a capability of theta. It's omitted that, and it is an enforced problem. The thetan in this universe doesn't recognize his capability of creating space. Yet he has a lot of trouble with space. You start to ask most thetans, now let's create space. Let's put out a couple of anchor points, now let's swap them around. He says, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, you don't. You say, come on, let's put out these two anchor points and let's swap them. No. I got them out there. And you say, well, all right, swap them. No. I just had a rather amusing session a short time ago where we put out two anchor points, which, of course, would be the first two points from which you would create the dimensions of space. You just postulate these two points. And I said, all right, let's turn those two points into black cats. And after a great deal of persuasion, we got those two points turned into cats. And when we got those two points turned into cats, we tried to turn the tail of one of the cat, just the tip of the tail, just one hair on the tip of the tail of the cat, a different color than the other cat's tail. No siree. And yet the preclear on whom this was being worked had a capability and mock-ups that most of you would envy. Isn't that remarkable? The second that we started to put out the first two requisites of space, there was such an insecurity on that whole thing that the preclear could hardly bring himself to go forward in any way, and it took an awful lot of practice. It took an enormous amount of time in order to get anything done about those two anchor points. The funny part of it is the GE is still operating on his anchor points. Any one of you have two points. And the GE is working on these two points. If you want to locate them sometime, just look out that away from your head and look out that away from your head, and you will find a ball out there and one out there. You start to shift those around, and you can just feel the whole beingness of the fellow just start to go to pieces. You leave those alone, it says. That space, that is how the space gets created so that we can have energy. But actually, they're just anchor points. That's all they are. There isn't any reason why you couldn't have 50 or 100 or 1. And yet the preclear doesn't want any of these. He has the self-imposed 2 in order to get an electronic flow. Well, now, therefore, we're dealing just slightly above the messed universe, and we know the capability of theta is a little bit wider than that which we see encompassed here in the messed universe. And knowing this, then, about truth and the primary postulate, we can also know that so long as an individual is willing to abandon havingness, he can change a postulate with ease. But when he is unwilling to abandon havingness, unwilling to abandon the possession which accrues to him solely because of his agreement, then he is going at the same time to maintain and hold on to his postulates. And the trick in processing would be to keep your preclear there in this universe and yet let him slide sideways into the creation of his own. That's quite a trick, because he's insisting on a continued havingness in the messed universe, and you're trying to knock out postulates which are contrary to the messed universe. You can do that with mock-up processing, but you're not likely to do it with much else. All right. All of these data have been covered before. You're quite familiar with them. Logic 9. Is a datum is as valuable as it has been evaluated. Poor old Homo sap. Where he was the sap beyond saps was believing that data as itself was worth anything. And data is worth absolutely nothing. Data is worth nothing until it has been evaluated. people keep coming around to you and they keep saying, you know, in Scientology, there's so on and so on and so on, and you say so and so and so and so. Well, do you know that there was a fellow by the name of a Pit Squealer in 1726 said, oh, how clearly, he said, yap, yap, gala, walla, walla, and he said the same thing that you're saying today. And you say, what's the same thing he said? And they give you some vague approximation. They say, truth is that for which every man thinks worthwhile, or truth is that toward which every man attains, or he says something about this line, you see. Or it'll be, self-determinism is the right of any man. And you say, well, gee whiz, he did, didn't he? Be very careful of one thing. Then where you look at that line in that book, be careful not to read the line above it or the line below it. Remember to read just that line. There sets the datum, but it has not been evaluated. An evaluation is relation to other data. An evaluation in our frame of reference would be how well in this universe it assisted survival. So your evaluation would be its comparison to other data and the magnitude of its ability to clarify, codify, or permit the persistence in surviving. So we have evaluation. Now, it's very true that you can dive headlong into almost any text on any subject under the sun and look through it, read a few billion words if you want to, but you will find practically everything that is worth knowing said by some man at some time somewhere. Everything that has been said in Scientology, I am sure, has in some fragment or another has been stated in the past. You put that together, you would have a library there which would be a very big library. Now, don't make this mistake after you've got the library formulated. You know very well where those books are. You would have a slip in each book. You would have that perfectly underscored. You know exactly where that line was. Now, don't let anybody come by and take those slips out. Because what would happen is you would pass down the library stacks and you would pick out a book, and it would be a book called Phrenology, The Rise and Fall of the Human Coco. And you'd say, I know there's one of the data of Scientology in this book. And you open that book up and you look through it. Well, I know it was in here someplace. Well, you put that book back. And you'd go and you'd pick another one of these books that you knew very well had been marked. And it would be German Imperial Frantics. The phoneticism of Immanuel Kant and written by his housekeeper. And you would get in and you'd say, well, there was one in there too, but I'm sure we'll be able to patch this thing up. That's not the way to research. And you could walk through that library endlessly and you'd never get Scientology back. And the reason why you'd never get it back is because the data was not evaluated. They weren't related one datum to another datum to an organization. The evaluation of a datum is, if anything, more important than the datum itself, because you can always get a datum. We could sit here and make a postulate and then try to evaluate the postulate. We could say, why is it that blackberries are red when they are green? Or we could simply make a statement that hereinafter blackberries will be purple when they are green. And then try to evaluate that datum in the berry industry and get people interested in the culture of berries to finally force this into being. You're just wrong way, Corrigan. What are we going to do then in order to construct a science or anything? The same thing you're going to do in processing a preclear. You know, I'm not just airing my teeth and talking about philosophy for the sake of philosophy here. I'm talking about very specifically with regard to auditing and in regard to learning material and data. And it's this. You're going to take the highest truth which you can state understandably and with accuracy and which you can relate to the remainder of the body of data which confronts you, and you're going to try to evaluate with that datum. And if it has limitations and doesn't expand the scope of what you're trying to do, you're going to have to find a higher level truth. You're exploring a preclear. You want to take this preclear apart, you would find the highest level of certainty which you could then attain, the highest level of truth which he could attain. And you would evaluate that preclear to a marked degree with that. If you wanted to put him together again, you could do that. And let's go look in the opposite direction. We find out we're going to make him capable. What makes him incapable is an inability. So let's just look him over and let's find out the specific inabilities. If we remove those, his native ability should restore itself. So we've got the opposite way of looking at it. Let's look for the lowest level of falsehood we can find in the case. And that would be the falsest datum. And then let's turn it into a little bit truer datum. And a little bit truer and a little bit truer until you had something sitting before you which much more closely resembled truth for himself. We don't want him much as truth for the messed universe because that's messed and we've got plenty of messed. Anytime you want to go out here and dig a hole, you can get lots of messed. So we want him for himself, not for the messed universe. And he is himself a universe. So the seeking for the highest level of workability would be seeking for the highest level of evaluation. What's the greatest certainty in this case? Well, that greatest certainty will tell you the highest datum that the preclear can reach at that time. And if you can find that certainty for him, you would be amazed. He'd probably turn on glow like a Christmas tree and walk out of the place and you'd say, now, wait a minute, we haven't done any more processing. We haven't done enough processing. I mean, we're supposed to go through this ritual and that ritual and some other ritual and do something else. And you haven't done that. All you did was reach in somewhere in the vicinity of his beingness and found out that he knew one thing above all other things. He just knew that and you just all of a sudden showed it to him, and he didn't know that he knew this. And you say, do you know that you knew that? And the fellow looks at it and says, my God! The guy can get pretty excited. Now, you get a lesser reaction when you demonstrate to him, do you know that you believe that all coconut trees have the Empire State Building in them? It's some ridiculous datum that's as silly as that, and he takes a look at that, and he finds out he's been forming up a whole lifetime on it. But that's invalidation to go at it that way, really. So you just sort of take it by mock-ups and let it work out. But as you work it out, you will find that as you're attaining a recognition in him of a higher level truth toward his true capabilities, when you're getting him up toward the higher truth of his own self-determinism and what makes his being tick, he's becoming freer and freer and more of an individual. A lot of people think in processing that the more you process an individual, the less individual he becomes. And you think he returns to the great swim, the big dunk. I use those reverent terms to describe nirvana. This is a pool in which all individuality and identity, those two things not even vaguely being similar, but they're put together with like that, and then they're dumped into this big pool. And after that, all is lost, and one floats in complete serenity and peace with the universe. That's right, with the universe. Only one difficulty with it that's perfectly true. There's nothing truer than nirvana. But you're walking on nirvana. And it's mud. And it's mud from there on down. Now, any time that you want to fix up a preclear so that he joins the infinite allness of allness in this universe, why, zap him with a zap gun or something and disable the Thetan so he can't even think himself elsewhere, junk the body and throw it in a lime pit. You've got him. That would be it. And by the way, this is supported by empirical data. You go out here and you look. You know, it's sort of hard. Once in a while, I run up against one of these communication breaks. I tell you, go out and look. You'll all be able to do this someday. But there is a point where experience gaps. I'll tell you what I mean when I said you go out and you look. I went to a theater, Queen's Poplar Theater, one of the old theaters. I was sitting there. All of a sudden, I felt vaguely uncomfortable and realized what I was doing. I knew what I was doing. I didn't suddenly feel uncomfortable, what I'm talking about. I just suddenly decided to fish around and feel all the lords and ladies that had been in this joint since the beginning of time. It was way back from Queen Anne's time or something like that, this old theater. And I was fishing around, and all of a sudden, I fished through the floor of the theater. Let's put a beam down through the floor of the theater. No. No. And I shuddered and kind of cringed into myself, and I went home that night, and I thought, boy, that's really rough. And I did a lot of mock-ups and so on and tried to get it straightened out and so on. But every once in a while, I kept shuddering over this thing. And that's the first time anything had made me shudder for a long time, and I didn't quite understand what it was because I didn't stay with it long enough to find out what it was. And I finally asked one of the boys, I said, what's wrong with the Queen's Poplar Theater? And he thought, he said, in the days of the Great Plague, that was one of the plague burial spots. They just brought them there in wagons and dumped them in. Well, here, all this time later, the ground of the Queen's Poplar Theater, not imaginarily at all, this is a lot realer than looking at things with mess perceptics, I'm pretty weak, is so soggy with agony and sordid putrefaction and death and so on that it's an awful jolt come in contact with it. You see, there's a lot of livingness still there. How do you like that? I mean, that ground isn't dead. That ground still has life. That's one of many nirvanas you can reach by going on into the messed universe. I say, go out and take a look. You could go down here past one of the graveyards. Amuse myself every once in a while. Go on over the graveyard and see how many thetans are stuck in the skulls. You know, they do this horrible thing these days. They embalm people. They take them, put them on a deal, they claw them open. And nobody ever occurs to anybody, I guess, really, to chop the tops of the skull off and empty the skull or do something about that or anything. No. All this, pack them all full of formaldehyde and preservatives, and let's paint the face so they look very alive, and let's be very kind to the body after it's dead, particularly after it's dead. Hell, well, what happened to the And let's take it out and bury it in a nice lead coffin which will protect our loved one from seepage. The body is very lifelike. And quite often a thetan cannot make up his mind whether or not that body's dead or not. He knows it's been sick. But he'll be groggy himself and he'll obviously still alive. If the smell of formaldehyde is sort of strong. And the smell of formaldehyde can get pretty overbearing, really. But you go down past the cemetery, and usually most country cemeteries where they sort of wrap them up in a blanket and dump them in on their heads and say, God be with you, rest in peace, planted by his loving wife Agnes or something of this sort. That's really very calm. They know Thetans left around there. But you go to one of these modern cemeteries, one of these nice modern ones. Boo! There's more trapped thetans around that joint than you care to measure up in a long day of Sundays. And if you want to amuse yourself, put out a line on them and say, hey, fella, why don't you get on your way? And they sort of feel groggy, huh? The voice of God, huh? Must be the voice of God. Well, you want to play God while you want to go down and do this sometime, just for kicks. And, yeah, put a little bit of an energy beam on them, and or plant the thought, you are now on top of the grave, or you are now on top of the headstone. And if you really want to pour the juice into them, it's kind of bad to hypnotize things, I feel sorry for them. But if you want to pour the juice in on them and go just burr, whap, you are now on top of the tombstone. There isn't any doubt of getting them out, truth be known. You can put out enough energy beam, you can sort of bore a little hole in a guy's head and then put the energy, concentration, flow into the center of his forehead, in, and his skull will go spatter, brains and all. This is no joke. I mean, I'm not joking about this. So there isn't any doubt about you getting somebody out of his head. It's just how tough do you want to get as an auditor? So anyway, you go down, you fish out a thetan or two, and you feel real good. You've done your Boy Scout trick. And the loved one then ceases to be troubled with seepage. Another interesting place to go. We got on this last night. That's why I'm mentioning it. Another interesting place to go is down at the morgue. They come in there, charred bodies, and they come rushing into the morgue with this and that, and fragments and bits and bones and things like that, and throw them into these big slabs that are on drawers. Open a big drawer, body size, and they dump the body in there. And they sometimes will lay them in some towns on marble slabs, and they tie a big tag on their big toe. And it has whatever identification of where the body was found. I don't know why they insist on doing that to a body, but they do. They take the big toe and they tie the tag on there and put it on the slab. Well, anyway, in these drawers, they push the drawer back in again, and people come in, weep, looking for their dear Charles, or something of the sort, and the attendant drags open the drawer, nope, next drawer, ouch, you know, slam, next drawer. By the time she's looked at four or five of them, she doesn't care whether she finds Charles or not. There's rarely any refrigeration in these places to amount to anything. But, you go in there and you talk about a bewildered lot of thetans. They come in. The guy's still hanging around saying, gosh, I'm dead. What about the wife and kids? I haven't paid the rent. And, why did I ever get mixed up with that steam boiler in the first place? And I should have noticed the nameplate on it was such and such an electric company. And he gets in, and you say, hey, why don't you shove off? And the fellow says, huh? Who's talking? Somebody talk to me. I got ideas. I guess I'm hearing voices. Big confusion. He's already real confused. And you push him around a couple of times. Once in a while, you feel like telling him, look, why don't you go back to the house and take a look? If you're so worried about how everybody is, just why don't you go back and take a look? And they just communication level and go back and take a look. The body's here, and I need the body to walk back with, and I couldn't do that because here's the body. Boy, that's really idiotic when you come down to think about it. The guy's got a charred piece of humanity. This guy just got through being blown up or something of the sort, and he knows very well it can't walk back to the house and pat the wife on the head. So you argue with him for a little while. In most cases, why, zip, he's gone to some between lives there, and back, and you go over to the hospital. You say, well, you meet a couple of them around and so on, and you think, well, gee, you know, that's real good. They come in, you say, hey, they question mark, who's this? This isn't on schedule. You say, hey, you trying to pick up a baby here? Something like that, big guilt feeling, yeah. Why don't you take that third one over there in the crib, something like that. Or are you the fellow that's supposed to tell us here? But mostly you have a hard time attracting their attention. They're very down tone scale, and they just go on in saying, I got to be a baby, I got to be a baby, I got to be a baby, I'm a baby, I'm a baby, I'm a baby. And there they go. fascinating. Very, very interesting. But they're pretty confused. Actually, Satan can straighten himself out if he's got the educational background of a few years as a stability, and he suddenly steps out on a gradient scale of reality. He knows he's here. He just hasn't been killed. He knows he's here. He walks out. He's still got the body. He can make up his mind. He has a power of choice. He can carry on with it, and he straightens out just fine. He doesn't have any difficulty. But you catch him off guard at times when he's already shocked and upset. Well, what's the difference between taking a Satan out when he's in fairly good condition? And is there any relationship between that and processing a pre-clear when his body's in pretty good condition? And doing something for a Satan whose body has just died or who has just got to have a body? Well, yeah, there's gradient scale. Your Satan who just lost a body, the highest level of truth which he thought he could attain was, I am a body. And that's pretty high compared to the state he's been battered into as a Satan. So he's got a low-level actuality, a low-level decision, postulate, or agreement, or whatever you want to call it, and he's got a body. And that has not been broken. But if he's just died, he's just lost that low-level beingness. His level of truth is just out, is just gone. He has no certainty. He hasn't a single datum of which he's now certain. He knows he's dead. Somebody's been telling him he should go to heaven. Somebody else has been telling him for sure he ought to go to hell. He's known all the time that he's got to go to station 862 and report in. But he's in a complete state of confusion. All right. Now, what do you solve? How do you solve this terrible confusion? Well, there's still another level of certainty, much lower than the certainty I am a body, that could actually be contacted. You have to figure out what it was. If you take a psychotic or a neurotic, there's still a level of certainty exists. And one could almost say that where a level of certainty ceased to exist, the life and beingness ceased to exist as well. Whether it's true or false, a certainty is a certainty. And so, there's some terrific analogy then, isn't there, between this word truth and the word life itself. And it all boils down to really just one thing. One thing. When he's completely free, actually the highest truth that one attains to is a truth of a certain sort. He can attain to higher truths than this as they exist. But before there is space for him, he does have a truth. And that truth is, I am. And as he goes down the line, it becomes, I am something. There's still I am, but the I am is less than, and the I am something, the something becomes greater. I am the something, and the I am becomes less, and the something becomes greater, until at last he winds up in the conviction that the something is all the I am there is. But as long as there's even a something that you can contact and communicate with, you can still start him back up the line toward I am. But you take off to restore I am, or his high level of truth, by restoring it on the gradient scale of the something. And so he's less and less the something and more I am, until he finally comes up into full awareness. And it's very hard for somebody who's saying, I am the something, to realize that the something is really one of the things which impedes his being I am. But that he is something still, and still knows that he is something, is enough to keep him from becoming nothing. And he holds on to the something in lieu of being nothing. But as he goes back up the line, he gets more and more I am, I am, I am. Now, then the highest level truth that you could attain with an individual would be the springboard from which you started out to reach the highest level that you possibly can attain for this universe, which is, I am with no need to be something. Let's take a break.